uprising in Syria by forces seeking to topple the regime of President Assad is now in its second year, and there is no sign of an end in sight to this crisis. A crisis where reports of atrocities committed against innocent civilians are increasingly common. Thousands of Syrian refugees are fleeing the conflict to seek refuge in neighbouring countries, among them Lebanon. They bring appalling stories of slaughter, rape and suffering. Patrick Nicholson is the communications head at Caritas Internationalis and has just returned from a visit to Lebanon, where he spoke to many of these Syrian refugees. He told me more about their shocking stories.
There are currently 7,000 Syrian refugees registered in Lebanon, but the number is much larger. It's around 26,000. Most of the refugees don't want to register because they're too frightened that their names will get back to the Syrian authorities and that they will be targeted because of that. When I was there on the border, we saw families coming across the border, so the flow is still continuing.
Are they often coming with just the clothes on their back, or are they able to bring some belongings with them?
The ones that I met that were just coming were really had nothing. They had a mat or just their clothes, really. They're absolutely nothing. I mean, they've fled cities which were under siege, so they fled through gunfire, through heavy shelling. Their homes have been destroyed previously, so they didn't have anything to start off with, and they're really coming.
And you say they're coming with tales of terror, of the killing of their loved ones. Can you share with us briefly one of these anecdotes?
There were a few stories. I mean, I did a dozen or so interviews, and about half of them would qualify as crimes against humanity. So there was one man, Mohammed, who just come across. His story was really tragic. He came from Homs, from Baba Amma, which was a suburb of the Syrian city which has really seen the worst of the fighting, and his baby son was born during the conflict. They survived by moving house to house, really, under shelling. They didn't have any water or any food. He had another three-year-old daughter. He was helping his neighbours get to these pop-up clinics where they're providing medical help. You know, they're very rough and ready places. And on one of these occasions, he was out helping a family whose house had been shelled. He came back and found his wife, his three-year-old daughter, and his baby son had been taken away. He later found out they'd been killed in his house, butchered, really, and their bodies taken away and used for ransom.
Did he ever recover their bodies?
He got them back and he buried them near a mosque, and then he left that day with his wife's family. That was really just one. I mean, another one which was very distressing was a woman. She'd seen her two nieces, 22 and 19-year-old nieces, raped in front of her eyes and then butchered by soldiers, her parents killed by snipers, two brothers dead in shelling. Another man had been arrested and stripped naked and had burning plastic poured on him. So they couldn't verify these stories. There was no way of verifying them, but it really built up a picture of human suffering and tragedy and brutal civil war.
And did they say who the perpetrators were?
The people I spoke to didn't know who the perpetrators were. In the case of Mohammed, he just didn't know, or he didn't tell me anyway. It's also, I think, important to say one of the families I spoke to, one of the women I spoke to, she had a two-year-old daughter. She'd just left Baba Amma in Homs. She was Christian, and her husband had been picked up by the opposition forces, tortured for 7 hours, and then dumped on his parents' front door. They couldn't get across the front lines to reach a hospital, so he died. And I think it builds up this picture of sectarian conflict, really.
Presumably, some of these people who were living there in places like Homs, you know, under the recent bombardment and siege there. What was the humanitarian situation like there? I know there was a lot of concern being expressed in the international community, but, I mean, what did they tell you what it was like living in that situation?
Well, I mean, the situation is still continuing. There is still shelling going on in Syria. There's still a humanitarian suffering in Syria, and the refugees I spoke to had left 4 hours before. We're talking about, you know, no food, no water, no medical help. So you had a dentist performing surgery for shrapnel wounds or bullet wounds. A man I saw with a bullet hole in his leg, they'd cauterized it by burning petrol on it. So it's a really terrifying situation of war. I mean, one of the things that Mohammed said, the man whose baby son and daughter and wife had been killed, said, you know, it's war, there are no rules, and it really is taking a heavy toll on the people.
That they must be very, very traumatised, I imagine.
I think that's right. I think the people that I spoke to, they spoke about what they'd been through in a very distracted way, as if it was happening to somebody else almost. They were distracted, they were listless, they couldn't really focus on what had happened to them. Caritas runs a shelter in Beirut where they'd cared for the woman who'd witnessed a rape. And the psychologist said that, you know, it was classic post-trauma stress, and she was very, very, very vulnerable.
These people you spoke to, was it often a situation, as you say, of a killing of a loved one or something that caused them to flee, but was it sometimes just the general conflict and the general mayhem that was going on that caused them to decide to, you know, go flee to another country?
Certainly most of the people who'd fled had fled because of the shelling, of the conflict. Some people who'd fled earlier last year had foreseen what was going to happen in Syria, and so decided to get out while they could. But the majority of people fled because of the humanitarian situation was impossible, so they had to seek safety.
And many of these people, I gather, are being hosted by Lebanese families in the Bekaa Valley area. I mean, that must be very tough on them as well, because these are very poor communities, aren't they?
Yes, I went to two places, the Bekaa Valley and then in northern Lebanon, in a place called Wadi Khaled. In Bekaa, they're mostly being looked after by Lebanese families. Families will share all they've got and help one family with either rent or providing them a place to stay. It's a very poor area of Lebanon anyway, so they're really struggling to make ends meet at the best of times, but they're able, with the help of organisations like Caritas, to provide food, blankets, fuel. And in Wadi Khalid, in the north of Lebanon, it's a slightly different situation in that many of the refugees are in centres, in community centres, in abandoned schools, and you're seeing families of six or so in rooms of about 8 meters squared, still very poor conditions, you know, water dripping down. I think I went to one school where the kitchen for the entire centre of 15 families was just two hot plates, really. They were heating water kind of jacked into the electricity supply in kind of big buckets, and, you know, children running everywhere. Very cold, very miserable.
Very miserable conditions. But the people don't resent these Syrian refugees coming in. They're, you know, they're happy to help them despite, you know, as you say, the difficulties this influx causes.
Well, the Lebanese people that I spoke to were happy, of course. I mean, they'd been through war in 2006 and then a terrible civil war. So many of them had been displaced. Many of them had seen what war looks like. And so they were doing all they could to help. The borders are quite porous anyway, so they were often family members helping each other. It would be fair to say that the influx of refugees is also causing some nerves in Lebanon. It's got its own very delicate balance between Sunni and Shia and Christian groups, and so there is some disquiet, of course.
Now, most of these Syrian refugees are Muslims, is that right? But are there also some Christians as well?
They are mostly Sunni Muslims. The government would be from a Shia sect, so the majority of them are Sunni. I did speak to Christian families too. There are some in the Bekaa Valley who have fled. And they have fled because of this terrible humanitarian situation, but also because, you know, they are being targeted as well, not by the government, but by opposition forces.
So quite a nasty sectarian strife situation developing there.
It's a real mess, basically.
And if this conflict does drag on, do you predict that the humanitarian situation is simply going to get worse? You get more and more people fleeing across the borders. You say Caritas is helping, but how many other people are helping these refugees?
Certainly the situation in Bekaa and in Wadi Khalid, there was no space for any more refugees. So if it does get worse, then there'll certainly be a need for a bigger international response. I haven't been into Syria, so I can't judge the situation there. But what I know from the people that I spoke to was that, you know, there are killings going on, the shelling is continuing today, the refugees are coming over the border today, and so the crisis, there's no real end in sight.
I was speaking to Patrick Nicholson, communications head at Caritas Internationalis.